Are you fucking real, man? Come on.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Swords, Sorcery, and Socialism, a podcast about the politics and themes hiding in our genre fiction. As always, I'm Darius, and with me is Ketho. How's it going?
Howdy. This time in real life.
Believe it or not, we both exist IRL. And today we're having a special recording because we're doing it in person.
This never happens.
I literally had to drive all the way to Ohio to make this happen.
Yeah, no one ever wants to do that.
I had to go past a billboard that said, all babies cry, take a break, don't shake. So I came into the state, and one of the first things I saw was the billboard telling you not to shake your babies.
I mean, good advice, but troubling that it needs to be said.
Remind Ohioans, don't shake your children to death. But today we're doing an in-person recording, and we are talking about a not book. This is one of the maybe second or third time we've actually talked about what is like an essay as opposed to a book.
Well, first essay we did was on fairy stories.
It's true. That was an essay. Maybe our second essay.
Maybe second.
I guess Omelas technically counts as a story.
Yeah, Omelas might just be like a prose essay.
Yeah, more or less. But today, we are talking about Michael Moorcock's 1977 essay, Starship Stormtroopers.
Where he calls a lot of people out.
It is, yeah. I mean, this is no different than like, was it that like Kendrick verse on the Big Sean song where he just calls out every other rapper alive and says he's better than all of them? This is basically that, but for calling every other sci-fi author fascist.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of funny, actually.
So I'm going to say, going into it, it's not very long. If you haven't read it before this recording, you can leave, pause this, read it in like 10 to 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's super super short, and it's on LibCom, yeah. So really easy to find.
Like, just Google it. The first link is libcom.org. So I'm going to say off the bat, I'm conflicted when I read this because on the one hand, I think he's generally right about a lot of what he says in this essay. I think he's correct. On the other hand, I feel like sometimes he goes a little too far, but I'm not sure if that is him actually going a little too far or if I'm simply annoyed that he has called me out to my face about my media literacy.
Yeah, so I was about to say, there is a decent chunk of this just like, hey, radical fans of Tolkien, fuck you.
Like, a lot of this is him literally looking me in the eye and going, be more critical of your media, you piece of shit. How can you like this author? His politics are bad. And Moorcock is very much in this essay doing a... you have to separate the art from the artist, because his whole argument is that even the art is fascier than you think it is.
Yeah.
And that we all lack the critical thinking or don't engage in it enough to understand that the art we're consuming is fash. Yeah, I think is sort of his deal here.
Fash.
I'm just going to say a lot because fascist is two syllables and I don't want to say all those.
But I mean, some of them you'd think it would be obvious. Like people are like, where he's like calling out Heinlein and it's like, you know, Starship Troopers is obvious. That's why he named the thing Starship Stormtroopers.
Well, because he also calls out Star Wars directly in this essay as well.
Yeah, that too.
But I think what he's more responding to with Heinlein is that I don't think he thinks people read Starship Troopers and are confused by it. I think he's calling out, quote, you know, so-called radicals for really enjoying, like, Stranger in a Strange Land, mm-hmm, or Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And like sort of forgiving Heinlein those things.
Yeah.
When we shouldn't. So what we're going to do, since this is pretty short, is we're essentially going to go through like one or two paragraphs at a time and just kind of talk about the ideas he's presenting to us in these. So as we like, because it's easier sort of just go through it in the order he presents things, because he does ramble a little bit, but this is also a thing he admits he's been complaining about for a while.
And that people just haven't been listening.
Yeah, and people haven't been listening. So he's very much like, this is my rant. Listen to me. And this, again, this came out in 1977. So I want you to keep that in mind when he first published this. This came out in 1977.
That's so, just so everyone remembers, that's the year that Star Wars came out.
Yes. which he's going to talk about specifically. But also, you can't be like, oh, he doesn't know about the way they treat the Force in fucking this extended universe thing. Those weren't written yet.
Yeah, none of that stuff was written. So he didn't... We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
Okay. So
the first paragraph kind of just outlines exactly what he's going for here, which is like the thesis statement, where a lot of these things are really fash, and he's really confused that so-called radicals who belong to the Monday Club are reading
reactionary literature.
Reactionary lit.
He also is in this essay, if you guys read it, he does name drop a bunch of authors you've never heard of, because unfortunately their work has, you know, not remained popular. He also name drops a bunch of like sci-fi like magazines, like the type of magazines that were popular in like the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where sci-fi authors would like publish their stories.
Yeah, and those are really curious. That's something I actually am really curious about looking into, because he had his own.
Yeah,
like,
and
he
mentions it in here.
And it got really controversial to a lot of science fiction fans because it wasn't as fashy as the rest of science fiction.
Yeah, he does bring up in here because he talks about them trying to oppose the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, and how complicated that was.
Yeah, the authors who were part of that journal had split opinions on it. And some of our, you know, authors we like are definitely on the wrong side of that issue.
Yeah, definitely.
So this first sentence, I'm going to read it to you because I think it really gets to the heart of this, is there are still a few things which bring a naive sense of shocked astonishment to me whenever I experience them. A church service in which the rituals of dark age superstition are performed without any apparent sense of incongruity in the participants. A fat Soviet bureaucrat pontificating about bourgeoisie decadence. A radical singing the praises of Robert Heinlein.
A naive sense of shocked astonishment. A radical singing the praises of Robert Heinlein. That's, yeah.
He then says he would be, you know, he compares
someone reading something like Starship Troopers with like enjoyment on a train as him being across from someone reading Mein Kampf with enjoyment. And he's like, what the
Well, let's be honest. He goes a little further than that. What he says was, if I saw people on the tube reading Mein Kampf, it wouldn't disturb me much more than if I saw them reading Heinlein, Tolkien, or Richard Adams.
Yeah, this is him swinging out the gate.
Dude comes out the gate swinging. Yeah. Saying if he sees someone reading Tolkien, that's about as shocking to him as someone reading Mein Kampf.
This is the thing that always kind of made me laugh a little bit when people are like, because a lot of people talk about like George R. R. Martin, like trying to push away from the strict good versus evil limitations of Tolkien and other things. I'm like, guys have been doing that since the 1960s. It's like the Elric series, to my understanding, and I haven't read it, but just from my understanding of it, is already pretty morally gray. So it's like there was definitely plenty of like reactive, like, no. This isn't how morality works. I'm going to write a story with more nuanced, like people were reacting to Tolkien in the 1950s and 60s.
And he says in this essay, he's like, these other people exist, but they're not popular.
Mm-hmm.
He like says people's names, like, this author does better work, but no one knows who they are. This author does better work, but nobody knows who they are. Everyone's instead reading this piece of shit.
Yeah. And everybody get out a piece of paper and write down the names of all of these, we'll get there, but he just starts listing people off later on the essay.
He goes full, like, opening of, like, the Iliad and just, like, is listing off names.
This is like, the opening. Which gospel is that? That has, like, the opening lineage where it's like, and he was the son of
Herod, son of Ham, son of Haran.
And he was the son of, like, Seth, who was the son of Adam. And it's like, wow, that's a perfect lineage all the way back to...
That's like I'm pretty sure that's like in Genesis or like something.
Well, it's in one of the Gospels, tracing Jesus's lineage all the way back to Adam. Yeah, yeah. And it's like, can you chill?
It says here, a look at the books on sale to, I don't know that name, Cienfuegos. I'm guessing it's like a sci-fi bookstore. A look at the books on...
Cienfuegos.
Yeah. a look at the books on sale to Cienfuegos customers shows the same old list of Lovecraft and Rand and Heinlein and Niven, beloved of so many people who would be horrified to be accused of subscribing to the Daily Telegraph or belonging to the Monday Club, and yet are reading with every sign of satisfaction views by writers who would make the Telegraph editorials look like the work of Bakunin and Monday members sound like spokesmen for the Paris Commune.
Yeah, so it's like, like these people would be like, if you accuse them of being in right wing groups like Daily Telegraph or Monday Club, and they'd be upset. Be like obvious, like I would be upset. But they were extremely satisfied to be writing from authors who would make the Daily Telegraph and Monday Club look like
radical.
Make them look like radical leftists in comparison, especially somebody like Heinlein. Niven, like he lists off the four really, really bad ones, I think, right off the bat there with Lovecraft, Rand, Heinlein, and Niven, like all being these extremely problematic people.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us anyway, it's not controversial to say those authors suck.
Yeah, it's really not at all.
But I don't think there was quite the like.
Oh, especially not in the 70s. Yeah. Like Rand was becoming popular. That's part of the reason. Like,
again, beat her to death with my. Yeah,
like that was the era when she was her most popular, and people were just like, wow, this is so good. And I'm like, it's written like a fucking fifth grader. it's so disconnected from the state of how reality even functions at a basic level. So right. It's like, how could anyone like consume this as science fiction? It's just pure fantasy. I like the idea of Monday Club members as spokesmen for the Paris Commune. That's really funny. He's a bit of a comedian.
Yeah, I mean, Moorcock's getting his digs in like as expertly as he can.
Yeah, this essay is, I think, prime example of how things get funnier the more specific you get.
Like when you're calling out a specific guy for saying a specific thing, it's way funnier than being like, people should stop saying this. When you say, he's like, hey, John,
he didn't. He didn't just say, hey, conservatives. It would make conservatives seem like leftists. Ha ha ha. He's like, no, it'd make Monday Club members seem like spokesmen for the Paris Commune.
I mean, the next sentence at the beginning of the next paragraph, he literally calls out a guy by name. It says, some years ago, I remember reading an article by John Pilgrim in Anarchy, which I assume was a magazine, in which he claimed Robert Heinlein as a revolutionary leftist writer.
The next line is so funny. As a result of this article, I could not for years bring myself to buy another issue. He was like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, Heinlein is a revolution. What the hell? This man was like virulently anti-communist.
Then the next line is a pot shot at state communists because he goes, I'd been confused in the past by listening to hardline communists offering views that were somewhat at odds with the anti-authoritarian claims, but I never expected to hear similar things from anarchists. So he's like,
you guys should fucking know better.
Basically, like, you should know better.
It's like, you guys don't worship like state apparatuses. You guys don't like military nonsense. Why the heck are you like worshiping a guy? Like, he's like, I get it if like fucking authcoms do it because they're all like, the state, blah, blah, blah. But like, come on, guys. Like, you're better than this.
He also then, a little bit later, makes a point which is still very common for you to need to make, especially on, like, Twitter spaces and online spaces, about calling yourself apolitical, which is shorthand for conservative, because he says a little bit further down, my experience of science fiction fans at the conventions, which are held annually in a number of countries, mainly the U.S. and England, had taught me that those who attend were reactionary, and in parentheses, claiming to be apolitical, but somehow always happy to vote Tory and believe Colin Jordan to have a point. So he says that he's used to going to cons and meeting people who are like, I'm apolitical, but like are always voting conservative.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, has not changed.
Oh, absolutely not. Those are the sort of people who are like, the Democrats are just being too radical, and so I'm a centrist. Well, does that even mean?
I'm apolitical. I don't believe in parties. I just vote for Republicans every single time.
Yeah, it's just whoopsies.
No, I voted for Obama once.
Once. Back in 2008, I voted for Obama.
Obama in 2008. Shut the fuck up.
I thought that Mitt Romney had some points.
I'm going to read this one because, again, it is just him calling motherfuckers out. I always assumed that for one reason or another, there are exceptions among sci-fi enthusiasts. Then the underground papers began to emerge, and I found myself in sympathy with some of their attitudes. But once again, I saw the old arguments aired. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Frank Herbert, Isaac Asimov, and the rest. Bourgeoisie reactionaries to a man, Christian apologists, crypto-Stalinists were being praised in IT, Friends in Oz, and everywhere else people whose general political ideas I thought I shared. Again, saying all these people who I thought I agreed with on politics are now publishing essays in favor of all these authors who are, again, reactionaries to a man, Christian apologists, crypto Stalinists.
Like what? Like he's just finding buzzwords soup here, like throwing everything at the wall.
But again, talk about the names he's throwing at the wall here. Now, some of these we obviously understand, like Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, clearly Christian apologists. C.S. Lewis is fucking wild as shit. When we eventually cover the Chronicles of Narnia, oh boy.
It's like, honestly, the last battle could be like a four episode, like mega series on.
Trevor has already requested that he be on the one for the last battle.
Well, that would be appropriate.
Because it is literally just Revelations.
Yeah.
And it's fucking weird. But, so sure. Like
Takes what could have been a good story and just kind of takes a massive dump all over it.
Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, clearly Christian apologist. He's talking about like Frank Herbert and Isaac Asimov, you know, as like crypto Stalinists and reactionaries. I'm not sure who's supposed to be who in this, but.
I feel like
he's going to call like Frank Herbert a crypto Stalinist or something. Anyway, he's taking a lot of fucking pot shots here.
I'm about to say, then, I'll go to bat for your boy, Frank Herbert.
And then he, Moorcock says that he began writing essays, you know, stating these things out, and that people started accusing him of being reactionary.
Yeah, that's really funny. He's like,
or being a spoil sport for basically telling people that their favorite authors were bad people with bad politics. And they're like, well, you're just being a spoil sport. You're not letting me enjoy my art. This is very much like, you're still listening to R. Kelly.
Yeah.
Despite knowing everything he did, but also R. Kelly's would be like, imagine if R. Kelly wrote songs that were like, I love having like underage sex slaves. And everyone was like, yeah, but the song's good though.
Yeah. Yeah. If his music more legitimately espoused his own views.
And they were just like, yeah, but I still like it.
It's like, he just, you know, he just has sex slaves that he gets to pee on him.
So his next paragraph, he points out, I think it was the name of the periodical that he either started or was part of called New Worlds. And he starts off by saying that they were attacked by all the people you would expect them to be attacked by because they were told that they had an emphasis in revolution. And so, as expected, they were attacked by like Tory MPs, by the Daily Express, yada yada, you know, people you'd expect to be upset with their content.
Wow, a Tory literally asked a question about them in the House of Commons about why public money, which was like essentially just a tiny Arts Council grant, being spent on them, even though the Arts Council grant, I'm sure, is like something that is spent like across the board, like on many different things.
Yeah.
And it's just like they just received a small portion of it.
Yeah. And the Tory MP, of course, still had to be mad about it. So it says, you know,
it's just an excuse so they can be like, we need to defund this thing so my taxes go down by 0.02% because that 0.02% is very important to my year-end dividends.
Fucking right. So he says, obviously, they're attacked by the people he thought they were attacked by. But then he says, but we're the only sci-fi magazine to pursue what you might call a determinately radical approach. And he just says SF is a shorthand for sci-fi. And sci-fi buffs were the first to attack us with genuine vehemence. Our main serial running at the height of our troubles was called Bugjack Baron, written by Norman Spinrad, who had taken an active part in radical politics in the U.S. and used his story to display the abuse of democracy and media in America. He later went on to write a satirical sword and sorcery epic, The Iron Dream, intended to display the fascist elements inherent to the form. The author of the novel existed, as it were, in an alternate history to our own. His name was Adolf Hitler. The book was meant to point to the number of sci-fi authors who were, in a sense, unsuccessful Hitlers.
Heinlein.
I think we keep saying Heinlein.
Yeah, because he's so easy to take a pot shot at.
What Moorcock's pointing out here is that's all of them.
Yeah, it's or like a decent number of them.
So they were attacked off the bat most strongly by sci-fi fans.
And this honestly doesn't surprise me that much because, I mean, I've had plenty of interactions. If anyone has followed me on Twitter for a while, is that one interaction with Warhammer fans that dogpiled.
Dude, the Warhammer fans got real mad at you.
Because I pointed out that all media is inherently political because of you know, the fact that anyone who creates it exists in a time and a place and a world. it's like, you know, and then they come at me with stuff like, oh, what about Big Titty Bimbo anime? And I was like that's pretty explicit. That's like a really, really obvious.
I forgot that they tried to switch. Like, oh, what about this anime is political? And it's like,
do you think that I blocked everybody? And they were like, why are you blocking everybody? It's like, because you guys are just annoying.
Well, it's if I had unlimited time, I could definitely go into all of the inherent politics.
I dropped a thing where I was like, hey, listen, guys, the politics of sexualization and politics of sexuality are absurdly complicated and have been written about 150 years. So I think,
like, not even to get into the way like women are portrayed in anime, like specifically,
but like, it's like, oh, the people who get most pissed about it are the people who are fans of the thing, because they don't want to like critically analyze any of it, because if they do, they might like come to some unhappy conclusions about themselves that they don't want to come to. And
which actually goes back to my admission at the beginning of this recording, is the fact that this essay annoyed me because it was right.
But at the same time,
makes me talk about my favorite authors in a way that's not good.
But at the same time, it's like, I feel like anarchists are used to, you know.
I think Moorcock's point here is that the reason he's so mad is because he expected us to do better.
Yeah.
That we should be more critical, and that we have, to his ideas, lacked in being as critical as he expects us to be.
And I see where his point comes from, because at its core, like, especially anarchism is like an inherently deeply self-critical analysis. Like it is, because it's like,
it needs to be,
it has to be. The whole idea of, you know, essentially perpetual, constant vigilance, etc.
Killing, like, the cop inside your own head.
It's a lot of self-criticism. It's a lot of self-reflection, and it would make sense. You'd think it would make more sense that people who would be self-described as being anarchist would be like, yeah, you know, this piece of media is political. Like, it's all still political, and, you know, like, there are views that are in here that are deeply problematic. And I don't even know if there's an issue with necessarily enjoying reading any of it. And I don't even know if that's his big problem here.
No, I think his big problem is that then radicals are going on to defend these works as if they are radical and good.
Yeah, it's like calling them radical even when they're not.
Yeah, I think he's not saying that you can't. I think he even says later, there's escapism is fine. Like, reading a book and enjoying it is totally fine. The problem is then going out and being like, Tolkien was actually radical, believe it or not. And you're like, not.
It's like he was pretty explicitly not. Like, no. He even himself was like, eh, I mean, I just want to go farm.
I fully admit that we'll do an episode about it at some point, that like the radical messages that I personally have taken from Lord of the Rings are ones that I took myself.
Yeah, and that you've like read into the text
that I have read,
something that Tolkien intended or something that most people read from the text.
Yeah, it's something that I personally intended, which is probably more of a reflection of the way I feel about things, and I assigned meaning to these stories as opposed to the stories having those meaning themselves.
Yeah.
Which is fine. But
say, any deeply radical content in something that Tolkien wrote would have been entirely self-perceived. You know, it wouldn't. Yeah. It's not something that Tolkien intended.
I think the one thing he might have intended as radical is his anti, like, industry.
Oh yeah, but yeah,
that's just a big shaking hands meme between Tolkien and Zerzan.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
a linguist and a guy who believes you should destroy language.
Bye bye.
Anyway, let's go on to the next paragraph here, because we're talking about a bunch of little Hitlers.
Oh man, this is his first name drop of someone I actually recognize as being a good author, because he talks about who came to New Worlds, like who was writing for New Worlds.
Also, and I think we don't have to feel bad about just reading large sections of text from this essay, because it is on LibCom.
Yeah, but
so I don't need to worry about being copyright struck.
But essentially, people came to New Worlds because they couldn't get their stories published
in other sci-fi papers
in the U.S. So like. And Moorcock is British, so like,
unfortunately,
they would, like, Americans would submit stuff to New Worlds because they were like able to publish it in the UK when the US was like being hyper, you can't do this.
Well, I mean, it's like we're like Cold War height. Like we're talking like the 60s, 70s. Like clearly they're not going to let anyone publish anything.
Yeah, and it's not even like paper. And it's not even like the government mandated that you can't do it. It's more like the
industry self-regulated.
The industry did not want to incur the potential wrath of the government, so they were like, "Nah, we'll just avoid this."
They didn't want to get McCarthy blacklisted.
Yeah, they didn't want to get McCarthy'd. And he mentions for the first time here Harlan Ellison, who I know as being really, really good from what I've read personally, but also like Thomas Dish, John Sladek, Harvey Jacobs. Again, these are people that not a lot of people know the names of. Like the most popular name in this list is Harlan Ellison, mostly just because I have no mouth and I'm a scream. Like that's like if people mention Harlan, that's the only one that a lot of people remember. Even though most of his work, and I assume most of the work of the people in this list, are pretty radical anti-authoritarian stuff.
Yeah, so he says in this little paragraph that he lists all those people, saying they came to him and they published a good deal of their best work, and at the time most controversial work in New Worlds, and Heinlein fans attacked New Worlds for, quote, destroying science fiction. Escapism this form might be, but it posed as a literature of ideas, and that we contended it wasn't, unless the Green Berets were a profoundly philosophical movie.
Yeah, he and this is something I'm finding interesting about Moorcock in this essay. It's like he also kind of looks at something like Heinlein and things like that as being a little bit, and I hate this word, but, and he never says it, but pretentious, where like posing as a literature of ideas when in reality it was just escapism. Mm-hmm. It's like, he's like, this stuff isn't like deeply philosophical, deeply meaningful. This stuff is just pure escapism for fascists who wish that it was more like fascism. Mm-hmm. And like, he's not even necessarily positing that the work of people like Harlan Ellison and stuff are literatures of ideas. Like, he's mostly like, science fiction is like, he's more self-aware, I think.
Yeah.
than most authors that are like, I want to do a big thing. And he's like, listen, guys, it's science fiction. Like, you can present some cool ideas, but try not to pretend like it's like, especially something like Heinlein. It's like, try not to pretend that this is like
some deep-minded nonsense,
some like philosophical text of deep importance. He's like, And I think he'd probably argue that there are very few examples of deep philosophical texts of great importance in general. But like,
I think he names one of them by name a little bit later.
Yeah, he does. Too.
Which will be unsurprising when we get to it.
But yeah, it's like he's like, guys, just stop pretending that this isn't just escapism.
Yeah. And while you can get good thought-provoking stuff from these other authors. So the next paragraph here is where he talks about the Vietnam War and sci-fi authors' reactions to it, and how unfortunately split their opinions on it were.
He even explains that the founding member of the Science Fiction Writers of America, Judith Merrill, was an ex-Trotskyist turned libertarian. And keep in mind, when he uses the word libertarian, this is just before the big shift, I believe, with...
It's right around the same time.
That
Rothbard
so
was stealing it.
I'm assuming that he's talking about anarchist libertarian.
Someone who would describe herself as such at the time.
Yeah, before it got Rothbarded.
Also, though, I do want to... I feel like... You know what? Never mind. I'm not going to make that point because I want to draw that heat right now. Anyway.
Was this something about like Trotskyists? Because even Bookchin was a Trotskyist.
Yeah. How an actual significant number of early 2000s neocons
were former Trots. Yeah.
A bunch of real reactionaries were former Trots, and that seems to be a theme.
Trot himself.
Yeah. But like there's a bunch of people that were like in the Bush White House. Like that era neocons who started off as Trots. And one of my favorite former Trots is Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, shit. That's a big one. Yeah. That's a big name.
Mm-hmm. started off as a Trot and then became Christopher Hitchens. So
that's a little fucked.
I don't know if I know any Trotskyists in like real life.
Because there's not very many.
There's
not very many radical leftists left.
They're also very busy at home printing more magazines, I assume, to actually be organizing. Sorry, my own pot
shots. The USSR would have been better if Trotsky were in charge.
Did you know Trotsky was Mexican at time of death? Because he lived in Mexico.
Because he lived in Mexico. He's actually a POC. He's not, believe it.
So in this, sorry, we're doing our own pot shots now.
Yeah.
He goes down here and starts talking about the split in the sci-fi community about the role of the Vietnam War, where they wanted to put something, wanted the organization to buy space in a magazine condemning the war in Vietnam. They wanted to buy space in sci-fi magazine, like in New Worlds, opposing the war in Vietnam.
Yeah, and this is being proposed to the entire Science Fiction Writers of America organization. So, like, this isn't just New Worlds, which probably would have very quickly been like, yeah, sure, go ahead and run that shit.
Yeah, this is, you're right. This is for the sci-fi writers.
This is for the organization writ large.
And it's not just America, because a lot of these are Brits. It's just sci-fi writers generally. But he proposed that a good number of members agreed, including English members like himself.
Agreed with alacrity. I love that.
With alacrity, which includes like Harlan Ellison, Harry Harrison, and then other Americans were keen on it as well, including Harlan Ellison. And he admits, to be fair, Frank Herbert and Larry Niven were also both anti-Vietnam War.
Yeah, it's really weird because he goes on to explain that that I think he says in here, right, that Herbert and Niven were anti the war, but were pro U.S. involvement. In a bizarre way.
I'll have to get down to that. But he points out that a bunch of other authors were outraged at the idea that the Science Fiction Writers of America shouldn't interfere in politics, which I think to him is just like an absurd point on its face, coming from the genre that science fiction is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it ended up being a situation where they ran two ads.
One that was
against the war.
And one that was pro-war.
And one that was in support of American involvement.
Okay, so this is an interesting bit here, because we've name-dropped a bunch of these authors before, including ones I've said I like. Okay,
oh, this next slice is going to be real rough for people.
So this next slice is, finally, the sci-fi magazines contained two ads, one against the war and one in support of American involvement. Those in support included Paul Anderson, Robert Heinlein, Anne McCaffrey, Daniel F. Glau, Keith Launer, as well as many other popular sci-fi writers that were against the war.
And as many other popular sci-fi writers as were against the war.
Oh, so there's as many people pro-war.
There were as many pro as there were anti, and some of the pro-war ones include people like Paul Anderson and Anne McCaffrey.
Yeah.
Which is like, what the hell, man?
The interesting thing was that at the time, many of the pro-U.S. involvement writers were, and by and large still are, the most popular writers, sci-fi writers in the English-speaking world, let alone Japan, Soviet Union, France, Germany, Italy, and Spain, where many of the good sci-fi readers think themselves as radicals. One or two other authors, British as well as American, are dear friends of mine who are personally kind and courageous people of considerable integrity, but their political statements, if not always by any means their actions, are stomach-turning. So he's literally saying,
even some of my friends are terrible.
Well, he's pointing out that these people, again, he's reinforcing the idea that these people who would otherwise, you know, consider themselves radical and are by and large the most popular authors for the genre, Anne McCaffrey, Paul Anderson, like these people who are wildly popular, are inherently reactionary in their stances and actions, even if they don't think themselves to be that way.
Ooh, this next section I actually really, really like, because this is him just straight up like, most people have to be judged by their actions rather than their remarks, which are often surprisingly at odds. Writers, when they are writing, can only be judged by the substance of their work. The majority of the SF writers most popular with radicals are by and large crypto-fascist to a man and woman. There is Lovecraft, the misogynistic racist. There's Heinlein, the authoritarian militarist. There's Ayn Rand, and this is great. I just love shitting on Ayn Rand. The rabid opponent of trade unionism and the left, who, like many a reactionary before her, sees the problems of the world as a failure by capitalists to assume the responsibilities of good leadership. There's Tolkien and that group of middle-class Christian fanaticists. Fantasists,
yeah.
He's just inventing words here, who constantly sing the praises of bourgeois virtues and whose villains are thinly disguised working class agitators. Fear of the mob permeates their rural romances.
Look, this is going to be this is where my inner fan comes out. I don't know at what which villain of Lord of the Rings is supposed to be a thinly veiled working class person. Is Sauron supposed to be working class? I think
we're also dealing with a time of leftism that was still very industrial.
Oh, I fucking hate that.
Were anarchists
that way in the 70s?
I mean, anarchists have always, like, anarcho-communists. That's like a broad.
All the ANCOMs like died after the Spanish Civil War. They're not still.
Let's
real.
Say like Anson's like lasted a while. But like,
I'm sorry, ANCOM friends. I'm just dunking on you. I'm sorry.
But like, specifically thinking of it as hyper industrialism is one way to look at it. But also, you know, the mob of the proletariat. it vastly outnumbers everybody else. Because there's millions more, like there's a shit ton more orcs than there are Numenoreans.
But again, if I'm gonna critique Tolkien for being reactionary, I wouldn't say that like the bad guys are thinly veiled proletarians. It would more be like it's a jerk off about like the good philosopher king,
yeah,
being necessary for a kingdom to survive. It'd be more like
which kind of goes like back to that the seeing the problems of the world as a failure by capitalists to assume the responsibilities of good leadership.
Yeah, like I think Tolkien would argue that his idea is that the world would be better if you had a good godly philosopher king.
Yeah,
like so like again, that's me just being pedantic because I feel called out. But anyway, let's continue.
To all these and more, the working class is a mindless beast which must be controlled or it will savage the world. The answer is always leadership, decency, paternalism. Heinlein in particular is strong on this. Christian values, etc.
And then it just, again, this is going to be reading hour because it's the only way for us to discuss it. He says, what can this stuff have in common with the radicals of any persuasion? The simple answer is, perhaps, romance. The dividing line between rightist romance, Nazi insignia, myths, etc., and leftist romance, insurgent cavalry, etc., is not always easy to determine. A stirring image is a stirring image, and can be employed to raise all sorts of atavistic or infantile emotions in us. Escapist or genre fiction appeals to these emotions. It does us no harm to escape from time to time, but it can be dangerous to confuse simplified fiction with reality, and that, of course, is what propaganda does.
That's a great point there, where this is what we were kind of mentioning earlier, where he's like you, escapism is fine, like it's not a problem to like get into this stuff and use it as, but you have to remember that it's escape because it's not real. Like the things that are being presented in this are not true and are not confusing hyper-simplified moral tales in fiction with the incredibly complex world that is reality is exactly the same thing that propaganda tries to do, to narrow reality down to a very simplistic set of rights and wrongs, to a very simplistic set of ideas, where it's like, you know why your life sucks? Because trans women, I guess. Very simplistic answers to very complicated questions.
Yeah, he's very much like, yeah, it's escapism, but it's designed to raise emotions, strong emotions in you. And sometimes it can be hard to tell whether that's a right-wing version of raising those emotions or a left-wing one. Like, you have to be careful which one you're like letting yourself indulge in. And this next section, he is essentially calling out the way sci-fi deals with heroes and how it's actually reactionary, the way heroes are often presented in science fiction. I think from a more political perspective, this section is also essentially a takedown of what happens to revolutionary leaders.
Oh, yeah.
Because the point, like, if you're the leader of the revolution, what often happens if you win and what you do with your position as leader. So you can also, I think on the one hand, this is direct criticism of just the way sci-fi as a genre handles their protagonists. But I think on the next level, Moorcock is also doing an analysis of how revolutions handle their leadership.
I mean, it's kind of like I would see this as like a direct dig at something like Aragorn, where the bandit hero. Like, he kind of is. Like, he's the Dunedain Ranger, like... Yeah.
At least, I mean, Aragorn at least never makes any pretensions that he's not supposed to be king.
Oh, yeah, no, he doesn't. But that's, like, he's still very much an underdog versus Sauron. And he says right here, the bandit hero, the underdog rebel, so frequently becomes the political tyrant, and we are perpetually astonished.
Such figures appeal to our infantile selves. What is harmful about them in real life is that they are usually immature, without self-discipline, frequently surviving on their charm. Fiction lets them stay, like Zorro or Robin Hood, perpetually charming. In reality, they become petulant, childish, relying on a mixture of threats and self-pitying pleading, like any baby.
Yeah, so he's essentially like usual people who are like...
These romantic, charming, revolutionary heroes.
Are usually actually giant babies. That once they actually achieve some kind of political power, just like start throwing tantrums constantly.
These are too often the revolutionary figures on whom we pin our hopes, to whom we sometimes commit our lives, and whom we sometimes try to be, because we fail to distinguish fact from fiction. If I'm going to get, you know, a lot of more general, like, socialists and leftists mad at me, I can point out that one of the main culprits of this, who still has not really been called out appropriately, is someone like Castro.
Oh, yeah.
Who specifically, his whole thing is charm. That's his entire thing. Mm-hmm. You go on Twitter right now and post a picture of, like, shirtless Castro, and you'll have a billion people wanking off about how much they want to fuck him. you know what I'm talking about. You have so many leftists who are like, who like go on and on about how hot Castro was and how charming Castro was.
Or like those pictures of young Stalin that aren't even actually pictures of young Stalin.
The not pictures of young Stalin. Or like, you know, the time the CIA sent an assassin and Castro seduced her instead. They talk about these stories all the time. What is that doing? It's mythologizing Castro to let him keep his charm so you don't have to get into the realities of him being essentially an autocratic ruler of Cuba, where he was criminalizing gay people. He was
criminalizing local religions.
Criminalizing local religions.
Indigenous religions.
Throwing anarchists in prison.
Throwing brown people in prison.
Throwing people who weren't as light-skinned as him in prison a lot. Like, there are a lot of reactionary bad things that the Castro regime did, especially in the first, like, 15 to 20 years of its existence. Like, they did a lot of bad stuff. But I think...
But it's like, look at this charming guy. He could never have done something but like that horrible.
Our internet specifically, I think, does what Moorcock is talking about right here, like, diegetically. The internet, like, continues to try and maintain the fiction of charm of Castro, because that's the only way to stop ourselves from actually having to analyze the fact of what he was doing. That's why I think you also get continued fascination with people like Che, because he died.
Yeah, that's exactly what he mentions in this next section here, actually, is that it's, in reality, is too often the small, fanatical men with the faces and stance of neurotic clerks who come to power, while the charismatic heroes, if they are lucky, die gloriously, leaving us to discover that while we have been following them, imitating them, a new czar has manipulated himself into the position of power, and terror has returned with a vengeance while we've been using all our energies living a romantic lie. And, like, this is very much you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Well,
I think what he's pointing is you die a hero, and while that guy is dying a hero...
A real skis bucket just became the guy.
Stalin becomes...
Yeah.
Stalin
while you're over here following Lenin because he's really charismatic and, like, a yada yada, suddenly, you know, fucking Stalin comes in next and just starts slaughtering everybody.
The whole point is that, like... Sure, there'll be a charismatic leader. Either gets appointed and becomes a petulant child, or he dies gloriously, and the person who takes over is an erotic pencil pusher.
Yeah.
And I know we're reading a lot of these lines because his prose is good. Like, he's making good points. That's why I want to read his actual words. Mm-hmm. The next line, oh baby. Read that next line for me, Ketho. It's going to be right here. Oh, yeah.
Heroes betray us. By having them in real life, we betray ourselves. Jesus.
Let's heroes betray us, and by following them and having them in real life, we betray ourselves.
That's real heavy.
Like, I know sometimes I'm back, but this is like we're a fellow.
This is pretty anti great man theory. This is pretty anti. This is pretty anarchist.
This is very much kill your heroes.
Yes,
if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him.
Kill him.
Like, his point is, we're anarchists. We should be doing better than this.
Yeah, it's like we should be understanding the fact that heroes don't exist. They don't exist.
Like, Paul Atreides is not a good person.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I get weird about him saying Frank Herbert earlier is because that's kind of also the point. But yeah,
I do think he's right though in saying that not a lot of people interpret it that way.
That's true.
So
I mean, people can, I think, should be held partially, not necessarily entirely responsible, because sometimes you write something and then it gets taken, swung the worst way humanly possible. But, you know, there's some degree of responsibility there as an author.
I think that also gets into some of what we talked about before a lot with things like Warhammer.
Yeah.
Where...
satire. Can you do fascist satire?
Yeah, like they keep trying to say that we actually don't think the humans are good, and then we'll publish 4 novels basically explaining why the humans are doing what they're doing and why they're justified to do it, even if it's bad. So like,
they're the least bad, and
it's a world full of bad people, and you just kind of have to pick the ones who are the least bad. But like,
are they really the least bad?
Are they the least bad? And also, like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't do this like...
Bro, I just want to go be one of the Warhammer goblins and just...
Do you know orc technology is my favorite technology ever?
Yeah, because you just put it together and it works for them.
It only works because they believe it works.
Yeah, and then...
It's entirely like... What's that? It's like... there's a word for that. Like,
it's like apotheosis or whatever. Like,
well, yeah, there's a word for like... It's like the idea that like a god exists because the people...
My knowledge, that I think collectively apotheosis is correct.
That or like an egregore or something like that. Where it's like...
apotheosis might be the process of someone.
Process of that. But it's like because we all collectively believe this god exists, the god exists. That's how orc technology works. I do respect that.
Hey, I stole that. That's part of my campaign setting.
Everybody. But anyway, kill your fucking heroes.
The heroes of Heinlein and Rand are forever competent, forever right. They are oracles and protectors, magic parents, so long as we obey their rules.
They are prepared to accept the responsibilities we would rather not bear. They are fiction of ideas that...
skipped a line there.
Oh,
sorry.
They are leaders in big quotes. Traditional sci-fi hero fiction on a huge scale... but it is only when it poses as a fiction of ideas that it becomes completely pernicious. Again, when you take these sci-fi tropes and apply them to real life, it's bad.
Yeah, I keep going, man, we shouldn't just keep reading every line, but like they're all great.
Every fucking line is good.
At its most spectacular, it gives fiction of idea. It gives us Charlie Manson and Scientology, invented by this SF writer L. Ron Hubbard, and an authoritarian system to rival the popes. It's like...
to claim it as radical is quite another. It is rather unimaginative. It is usually badly written. It is old. Its characters are ciphers. Its propaganda is simple-minded and conservative. Good old-fashioned opium, which might be specifically designed for dealing with a potential revolutionary.
It's like, haha! This is literally whittling you down and making you less radical.
Literally, like, again, that also reminds me of like the Le Guin quote about Rowling. Just the way he's like, this is unimaginative, badly written, simplistic, conservative, and stupid.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the fucking line about this. And politically rather mean-spirited. I like how she like slides the
yeah.
Because Rowling is more like
ethically
mean-spirited.
Yeah.
Because Rowling is more like a perniciously annoying liberal.
I wouldn't even call her liberal anymore.
Like, well, I mean, she's liberal in the sense of like what the Labor Party is and what the
I guess
Democrats are now. It's like Nixon era Republicans, you know? Yeah. Like,
oh man, Moorcock would hate Rowling so much.
Oh, is he still alive? I can look that up real quick might be.
Is he past tense or present tense?
Are we gonna do?
Because I'm saying, if he alive, I'm sure he hates Rowling with like a fiery passion.
No, he's
hell
he's
yeah.
Still alive. Oh, he's old. He's 82.
What a champ!
I'm sure that he's probably just like, shut the fuck up. I don't want to deal with this anymore. I'm just gonna go like hide in whatever house I've got.
I saw something recently. They're actually gonna be putting out another Elric novel or something.
Hey, listen, you gotta. Even when you're like in your 80s, you got to capitalize, you know, you got to.
Let's scroll down a little bit here.
Yeah, Lovecraft is a terror of sex.
Basically, we won't read from this one. It's just a paragraph about why Lovecraft sucks. I think we've covered that quite a lot. Mm-hmm. He talks about how Lovecraft is scared of sex. He's scared of ugliness. He's an anti-Semite. And that a lot of his work can just be compared directly to fascism. Farnham's Freehold is to Hitler's Lebensraum.
This line I am going to read, though, because I think it's funny. He wound up marrying a Jewess, which might or might not have been a sign of hope. We haven't her view on the matter.
Yeah, so like it might have been a sign of progress that he married a Jewish lady, but we can't ask her about it.
We're just going to have to assume he was a piece of shit forever.
Then he admits here that he's not taking like a very consistent critical line, that he's basically just bitching because he assumes that we all know who he's talking about.
Fiction about kings and queens is not necessarily royalist fiction any more than fiction about anarchists is likely to be libertarian fiction.
Just because your book is about a king doesn't mean it needs to be pro-monarchy. But on that same thing, just because your book is about anarchy doesn't mean it's actually anarchist.
Yeah, I was about to say, we get to see that plenty of times in modern media where like anarchists are depicted and depicted poorly. As a writer, I have produced a good many fantastic romances in which kings and queens, lords and ladies figure largely, yet I'm an avowed anti-monarchist. Catch-22 never seemed to me to be in favor of militarism, and just because many of Heinlein's characters are soldiers or ex-soldiers, I don't automatically assume he must therefore be in favor of war. It depends what you use... what use you make of such characters in a story, and what, in the final analysis, you are saying. Where it's like you can have a story with soldiers, ex-soldiers, kings, queens, lords, ladies, and you aren't necessarily writing a story about...
why those are good.
Why those are good. But when someone like Heinlein comes out here and writes a story about why soldiers are good and war is good, and the story is about that, and it has soldiers and ex-soldiers in it, and they're presented in a way as being like... you know,
correct,
then it becomes a serious problem.
Yeah. He goes and talks a little bit about the beginnings of sci-fi. He does a little comparing of like Jules Verne and H.G. Wells.
Oh, he likes H.G. Wells a lot.
He does like H.G. Wells a lot. He does say that Jules Verne has some pretty good sentiments.
He calls Captain Nemo semi-anarchist, embittered rebels who've retreated from society.
Yeah, like Codger, Captain Nemo, that sort of thing.
But at the end, he's like, they're essentially romantic outlaws, and the views they express are not sophisticated even by the standards of the 1890s.
Well, because if you're in the 1890s, you could also read things like News from Nowhere.
Yeah, I was about to say, you could be reading...
story by William Morris that reviewed a little while ago that are actually way more radical than that. He does... really like H.G. Wells, though.
Oh, yeah. H.G. Wells was a socialist, was a self-declared socialist. What was unusual about Wells, however, is he was one of the first radicals of his time to take the trappings of the scientific romance and combine them with powerful and telling images to make Bunyan-esque allegories like the Time Machine and the Invisible Man. Wells didn't have his characters talking socialism. He showed the results of capitalism, authoritarianism, superstition, and other evils because he was a far better writer than most of those who have ever written science fiction before, or since he made his points with considerable clarity.
No, so he's a much better writer than those who have ever written before or since.
And he even does take a little bit of a dig at Morris. You know, just a good, Morris had been long-winded and backward-looking.
Which we even did talk about, the fact that Morris was a bit more like back in the day, because Morris had a bit of medievalism in him.
Yeah, he did, and that makes a little sense, because he wanted to, like, he was even enamored by it enough to write fantasy the way he did, where, like, it was about writing old romantic stories. He just didn't want to write it in England.
We talked about in the episode that his sort of romantic medievalist ruralism actually isn't that divorced from Tolkien's, in terms of, like, we need to go back to the land and live in, like, nice little houses on a little farm.
And this is probably why he considered himself a libertarian socialist and not an anarchist. Like, he wouldn't have called himself an anarchist like somebody like Kropotkin would have, because Kropotkin was an industrialist to an extent. Like, he was pro-industry.
Unfortunately.
But he makes a great point here where he's like, Wells is brilliant because he didn't make his character sit around and talk about socialism. He just made his stories polemics on why capitalism, authoritarianism, and superstition are bad.
The News from Nowhere is literally just a guy sitting there and being like...
And that's even, I think, the reason that he later calls The Dispossessed a little journalistic.
Yeah.
Is because it is just kind of... But the thing is...
It is.
It gets more into that. It's more complicated than
that. But he's pointing out that what H.G. Wells does... Wells took the tech. He talks about Rudyard Kipling a lot in this essay. We haven't talked about him yet, but he talks about Kipling a lot because Kipling was sort of the progenitor of a style of storytelling that then was a sort of picked up by a lot of British authors. The way Rudyard Kipling wrote.
Yeah, because I know very little about Kipling.
I mean,
Kipling just sounds like the last name of an astronomer to me.
I mean, you should be aware of Rudyard Kipling. He wrote The Jungle Book. He wrote.
Oh yeah. Okay.
He wrote. All those sorts of stories. He wrote a bunch of other things. He was also like pro like colonialism for the British Empire. Like he was born and raised in British India.
Oh, Jesus.
His pro militarism got his son killed in a war by like convincing his son that he should join the British military. And then his son died, I'm pretty sure, in like World War I. So, but Rudyard Kipling, despite having like some good works and popular works, like everyone knows Jungle Book. Within the Jungle Book, I, growing up, was a huge fan of the animated version of Rikki Tikki Tavi, of like the mongoose that kills the cobras.
Oh, yeah.
Love the animated one because it's also narrated wonderfully by, you know, someone you guys would recognize. You should look it up, but you can watch it for free on YouTube. But Rudyard Kipling also was the guy who invented the phrase white man's burden.
That's fucked. That's actually really fucked.
Because he believes like the white man's burden to go to India and like teach Indians how to be civilized. So,
Jesus like, Christ, as though, like, before the Industrial Revolution, they weren't outproducing and out, like, competing Britain and the entirety of England in, like, every metric.
Yes. But he's very, like, Rudyard Kipling is that guy. But he also wrote a fuck ton of, like, fiction. He wrote all these, like, animal stories. He wrote all the, just a pile of stories. And he was wildly popular in England. And his, like, style of storytelling, the way he constructs his stories and that sort of thing, is what, Moorcock is talking about the fact that a lot of people imitate Kipling's style is that the way in which he formatted his writing and his stories sort of caught on as to whether you liked him or not. Mm-hmm. You imitated his writing because that's the style.
That's what it was.
So when he's talking about H.G. Wells here, he says he took the techniques of Kipling and preached his own brand of socialism. Until Wells, who he calls the most talented, original, and intelligent writer of his kind, almost all of science fiction had devoted itself to attacks on decadence and military unpreparedness, urging our leaders to take a stronger moral line and our armies to re-equip and get better officers. That's all Kipling. And by large, this was much of the tone of the sci-fi which followed Wells, from Kipling's but effective reactionary with the Night Mail and as easy as ABC, paternalistic, blah, blah, blah.
Buchanan, oh my Michael God, Arlen. Paternalistic aerial controllers whose rays pacify the mob? That's fucked as hell.
Amazing.
Oppenheim, Arlen, Buchan, Lequex? Who the heck is that? That name is amazing. Probably terrible.
Hundreds of others who predominantly were following Kipling in warning of the dangers of socialism, mixed marriages, free love, anarchist plots, Zionist conspiracies, the yellow peril, and so on and so on. Even Jack London wasn't what one might call an all-around libertarian any more than Wells was when he toyed with his ideas of an elite corps of samurai who are actually not a great deal different from how Soviet Communist Party members saw themselves or were described in official fiction and propaganda.
Well, Wells was a, to my knowledge, state socialist.
Yes.
So it's, you know, that's not too surprising.
This is Moorcock being like, look, Wells was the best.
But he still kind of sucked.
He still kind of sucked.
At moments. He's like, he's the best science fiction author who ever lived. Also, he still had some bad ideas that really make me uncomfortable.
Right here he's saying that like Jack London, who is presented as being like a sort of a libertarian.
Yeah, like a rugged, like outdoorsy like I'll live on my own.
Yeah, sort of thing. Is still proposing things like a group of samurai that are basically that behave in basically the way the Soviet bureaucrats portray themselves.
Yeah, it's
so like it's actually not that different.
Oh,
by
God.
And large, the world we got in the 30s was a world of sci-fi writers of the...
World the sci-fi writers of the day hoped we would have.
Sorry, the world that we got in the 30s was the world sci-fi writers of the day hoped we would have. strong leaders reshaping nations. The reality of these hero leaders was not, of course, entirely what had been visualized. Nuremberg rallies and strength through joy, perhaps, but Kristallnacht and gas ovens seemed to go a bit too far. So he's pointing out that the world of the 1930s was the world that sci-fi up to that point was saying we should have.
We should have a time when strong leaders should reshape all of our nations, yada, yada, yada.
And he's
but
saying
then what actually happened wasn't just like a reshaping of nations. It was mass death and, you know.
Genocide.
Genocide. Like, it was like, this is not, like, they all viewed this like paternalistic, like, we will usher the world into a new positive age. And it just turned into absolutely like slaughtering millions of innocents.
Yeah, he's saying like, oh, that's what the world they wanted. It just went a bit too far.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously really sarcastic, but like that's.
So the next section, I don't think we need to go over in detail. It's too much detail. It's about the couple American like pulp magazines run by a guy by John Campbell. Astounding Science Fiction Stories, Amazing Stories and Thrilling Wonders.
Even I've heard of these. Like I've heard. What's funny is these are all the magazines I've heard of.
Before. Yeah, like
Astounding Science Fiction Stories I've heard of before. I've heard of New Worlds.
I've heard of Amazing Stories
and Thrilling Wonder.
Yeah, these are the essays people are publishing things in. And he talks about here even like sci-fi authors and like people running these magazines like John Campbell in the time after like before and like after World War II were like wild-eyed paternalistics, fierce anti-socialists whose work reflect deep-seated conservatism, and
saw a Bolshevik menace in every union meeting. That's a great line.
They believed, in common with authoritarians everywhere, that radicals wanted to take over old-fashioned political power, turn the world into a uniform mass of workers with themselves as the commissars.
I mean, are they wrong?
They were about as left-wing as the National Enquirer or the Saturday Evening Post, where their stories would sometimes appear.
They were xenophobic, smug, and confident that the capitalist system would flourish throughout the universe, though they were, of course, against dictators and the worst sort of exploiters, no longer Jews, but often still aliens. Rugged individualism was the most sophisticated political concept they could manage. In the pulp tradition, the code of the West became the code of the space frontier, and a spaceship captain had to do what a spaceship captain had to do.
Like, all of you suck ass.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I enjoy watching. This might be a bad admittance. I enjoy Firefly, but that's just Firefly in a nutshell.
Yeah, captain's gotta do what captain's gotta do, baby.
Yeah, the movie is exceptionally lib too, so it's like.
I mean, it was written by Joss Whedon.
Yeah, I know, because he's exceptionally like.
Joss Whedon is like.
He's
Joss Whedon.
He's just kind of an idiot. You know,
Joss Whedon is nerd Aaron Sorkin.
Never really thought of it that way, but that works.
He's Aaron Sorkin for like sci-fi and like fantasy people.
Because to me, he's always struck me as somebody who's like really politically illiterate, like in the most extreme way, where he thinks, ooh, this is a cool concept for my thing. And it's like, it's kind of like this, and doesn't even think about the implications. Like he made Firefly and was like, ooh, there's like a civil war thing going on, but didn't think about the implications of making the main characters have fought for the side of what was essentially the Confederacy. Like, he didn't think about it. But I don't think he was, like, sitting there intentionally writing a polemic about how good the South is or anything. He was just like, a big government and a weird pastoral group, and they fought the law, and the law won, and they were like, and he was like, that's just kind of cool, right? And, like, didn't even think about the implications of what he was talking about at all.
But I think Moorcock would argue that that's the whole point.
Yeah, I know.
It's because at his core is conservative. He can write that story and not even think about the implications of it.
Well, yeah, because he's like the I don't even know if he thinks of himself as apolitical. I just think he thinks of his work as apolitical because he doesn't even think about it for 10 seconds. Yeah. He just kind of puts it down on the page.
That's why I think he's like a weird. So he's a comic book nerd's Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, so
Aaron Sorkin is at least aware that he's making political statements.
Yeah,
he's just like, making really stupid political statements. But like the kind of
anyone has ever watched JoJo, that's how I feel about JoJo's Bizarre Adventure 2. it's the same thing as Joss Whedon, where I'm like, this guy is not thinking about the potential political implications of any of the things he's written down. This is incredibly fash.
The people whose parents grew up idolizing West Wing their kids grew up idolizing Joss Whedon.
It's so funny.
It's the same kind of people, and I'm going to stick to that.
Listen, I'll give everybody their camp. You guys can watch Buffy and be excited about how campy it is.
I mean, Buffy, I think, is generally slightly less political than some of the other stuff Whedon has done. It's also some of his less aggravating.
Personally. I don't know. I couldn't finish Buffy. It was too camp for me. Well, it's too camp for
it's
me.
It's incredibly camp, but you know.
I'm gay. I'm not that gay.
This next paragraph is basically him talking about how people like Campbell, who ran the magazine, and other authors like him, they handled themselves like they were writing Westerns. They weren't writing Westerns. And what they were doing, they said themselves, they believed that they were doing, like, creating ideas. They thought they were putting forward sci-fi with the intent of putting new ideas out there. But what had happened was a bunch of their ideas ended up being adopted by, like, governments
and
the military. Because all their ideas they were putting out were inherently conservative, reactionary ideas.
Yeah. Like, they weren't presenting new ideas. These were old ideas that conservatives had had for, like, 3,000 years. Yeah. And they were, like, parroting them back as though they were something new. And then trying to present it as though these are, like, new, interesting ideas about how the world is and how the world should be and yada yada. And I like his first line here about how the war helped. It provided character types and a good deal of authoritative sounding technological terms which could be applied to scientific hardware and social problems alike, and sounded reassuringly expert. In
this is him
marks.
Talking about the Vietnam War.
Yeah. So he's, like, also mentioning that, like, Vietnam War, World War II, all of these wars, like, presented people with, like, a bunch of technological terms that they could use to make themselves sound smarter.
When they were writing sci-fi.
When they were writing science fiction.
But that's where he says it works both ways, because the military then adopted names for things that they took straight from sci-fi.
Science fiction, yeah. Yeah.
Let's go down here, because he talks about L. Ron Hubbard.
He talks about
Dianetics and L. Ron Hubbard, because L. Ron Hubbard's a piece of shit.
Just so everybody knows, I posted on Twitter a while ago, we did get a Scientologist sneakily putting a bunch of pamphlets out at the food pantry I work at.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, just putting it on a table without telling us and then walking away, hoping that some of the, you know, pretty vulnerable people who come in there to get stuff would have taken one and become Scientologists. I did throw them away, but I did keep one and post it on our post-it board because I thought it was fucking hilarious.
Amazing.
It was like, do you like, it's like, the key to your car is your key. This drives your car. This drives your soul. And it was like Diegetics or whatever.
Amazing.
At Dianetics. And I was like, I was like, this is insane.
So the end of this paragraph, he's talking about John Campbell, the guy who ran, like, Amazing Stories and these other magazines. Increasingly became more ravingly conservative across time, like quasi-messianic and a bunch of other things. He talks about being on a panel with this guy and some of this guy's views. And you guys, this is some heinous shit.
See, I would have loved to see weird mixed panels at cons like this, because I would just be like, holy shit, what is happening?
So he said that this guy, John Campbell, was the first one to regularly publish L. Ron Hubbard. It was his magazine that first published Dianetics of the Mind. He also, when faced with the Watts riots of the mid-60s, seriously proposed and went on to proposing that there were quote-unquote natural slaves who were unhappy if freed. This is the guy who was in charge of multiple sci-fi rags in America.
Yeah, he was the head editor, able to, like, say yes and no to pretty much anything going on there. I sat on a panel with him in 1965 as he pointed out that the worker bee, when unable to work, dies of misery, that the Mojiks, when freed, went to their masters and begged to be enslaved again, that the ideals of the anti-slavers who fought in the Civil War were merely expressions of self-interest, and that the blacks were against emancipation, which was fundamentally why they were indulging in leaderless riots in the suburbs of Los Angeles. I was speechless. Actually, I said four words in all. Science fiction, psychology, Jesus Christ, before I collapsed, leaving John Brunner to perform a cool demolition of Campbell's arguments, which left the editor calling on God in support of his views, an experience rather more intense for me than watching Dr. Strangelove at the cinema.
So the guy who is making the final editorial call on science fiction stories in America through the 60s was a guy who believed that some people were naturally slaves, that, like, people were happier enslaved. The people who were emancipators in the Civil War were just doing it out of self-interest. Like, this is the guy who is gatekeeping science fiction. A lot of science fiction.
That whole self-interest thing just reads reeks of objectivism to me. It makes me really fucking mad.
And the point is, what I think Moorcock's pointing out here is not that this guy specifically ruined sci-fi all by himself. The point is that he was surrounded by authors who agreed with him, and that the readers of his magazines were reading these stories uncritically.
That he was presenting with his views embedded in them.
Yeah, he was presenting stories that at least agreed with or didn't directly contradict his views.
And because he was a conservative and therefore he got very little backlash from the state, from the
establishment.
The establishment in general got very little backlash, despite his work and the work that he was allowing to be published being full of ideas that he was personally okay with and that wanted to disseminate throughout the population.
And Moorcock, again, circling back to the entire point of this essay, is Moorcock is saying this is what was happening in sci-fi in the 60s, and most radical readers weren't
thinking about it,
or were not critical of the works they were reading. Because, like, these are at cons. So you hear this guy, he was saying this at a fucking con panel. This isn't like he wrote it in a journal that other industry professionals read.
This is one of the things where I'm kind of glad.
He was saying this in public at a fucking convention.
That, like, now would, like, I feel like con spaces have gotten so much better if that's the case. Jesus.
I mean, I would argue that cons are probably better now than they used to be. I would say that even though there's probably still lots of reactionaries at cons.
They at least have to keep their mouth shut.
Yeah, most of them have to keep their mouth shut now at these cons, more or less. Yeah. And the people that don't keep their mouth shut are, like, more increasingly isolated.
But then there's, of course, examples like, you know, cons where, like, Anita Sarkeesian would get, like crap thrown at her. And
yeah, but that's getting into, like, I almost want to call that a slightly different form of reactionary stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's getting more into gamers.
Yeah.
Who do overlap with sci-fi fans. But that's not who Moorcock is
talking about. Yeah, no, I know. Moorcock knows. Someone doing this now. Like, that's
going up there and being like, some people are naturally born slaves.
It's like, and you would get a shit ton of people who would be like, he's just speaking truth to power.
The thing is, those people would only be saying it on Twitter.
They wouldn't say it at the con
because they would get their ass.
Because they know that they would get mobbed.
They'd get their ass beat by a furry.
Yeah. Somebody in a giant freaking fox fursuit would pick them up and throw them against the wall.
Which, good. unironically, the furries have done a way better job at denazifying their own communities than most other communities.
Hey, listen,
have.
one of the most important developers of the COVID vaccine, who's on Twitter, she presents herself entirely through her fursona on Twitter. Yeah.
We are entirely furry allies on this podcast.
Oh man,
get over it.
Oh, and keep in mind, Campbell approved Heinlein's Starship Troopers as to be serialized in Astounding Tales, just so everybody knows where Starship Troopers originated.
It came from the guy who thought they were natural slaves.
Which, what a surprise that he would publish Heinlein.
Now, he describes Starship Troopers a little bit. We don't need to do that. He talks about how Atlas Shrugged, how popular it was, and how much it sucks.
Yeah, he mentioned that Heinlein started writing Farnham's Freehold and Stranger in a Strange Land. And there's a line here where it's like, I kept finding that supporters of the Angry Brigade were enthusiastic about Heinlein, that people with whom I thought I shared libertarian principles were getting off on every paternalistic bourgeois writer who had ever given me the creeps.
So he's like, authors who I hated, people who I thought were my friends, were just rabidly defending these guys I hated.
It's like, I still can't fully understand it. Certainly I can't doubt the sincerity of their idealism, but how does it equate with the celebration of writers like Tolkien and Heinlein? The vagueness of the prose, which allows for liberal interpretation, ciphers they use instead of characters are capable of suggesting a wholly different meaning to certain readers.
Which is what I specifically have done
with Tolkien. To me, their naive and emblematic reading of society is fundamentally misanthropic and therefore anti-libertarian. We are faced once again with quasi-religion. Presented to us as radicalism. At best, it's the philosophy of the Western applied to the complex social problems of the 20th century. It's Reaganism. It's John Wayne and Big John McLean and the Green Berets. It's George Wallace and Joe McCarthy. As it is most refined, it's William F. Buckley Jr., who, already a long way more sophisticated than Heinlein, is still pretty simple-minded.
I love
and
this guy.
And he even is calling out, like, the big issue with individualism, like rugged individualism, that sort of like modern conservative libertarian principle being going hand in hand with paternalism. It's like a strong faith in paternalism, albeit a tolerant and somewhat distant paternalism, and many otherwise sharp-witted libertarians seem to see nothing in the morality of a John Wayne Western to conflict with their views, despite the fact that it's a Western. Like
Westerns are like almost inherently,
yeah,
as a genre, almost inherently reactionary to begin with, unless you specifically make like an anti-Western Western, yeah, like which some people did,
yeah,
where like you inherently are making a Western.
Those anti-Western Westerns, though, were kind of like the end of the Western. Like they were, yes, like the death knell of the Western, yeah, because people realized that they weren't interested in the Western anymore and were more interested in the deconstruction and destruction of the Western.
Of the genre. I've seen like video essays talking about how like you can sort of track that.
Blazing Saddles was the final nail in the coffin for the Western, really. Which,
good.
Yeah.
But like, I've seen essays pointing out that like you can actually kind of track this across the popularity of different genres of media, where like you'll basically get it new and earnest, and then it sort of reaches like a zenith of where it is the most it can possibly be.
And then we suddenly get The Boys.
Well, yeah, and then you get a downturn where people are critiquing and deconstructing that genre itself. And I think the one I talked about was talking about comparing Westerns to superhero movies, mm-hmm, and saying that we are now we've approached the era of like essentially saturation of the genre, and we've seen it at its most it. Like we saw Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah.
Like we saw,
say Infinity War and Endgame was like the end, because they built so far, and it's like now they'd have to rebuild.
That's like the apotheosis of the genre. Mm-hmm. It just is like that little era of the MCU. It is, like, whether you like it or not, that's the genre.
Yeah, the modern superhero epic is now.
Despite Disney continuing to try and make more of them,
if you say I saw Thor: Love and Thunder and it wasn't that good, it was pretty bad actually.
That's why you see, even though they're making more of them, there's a general downward decline in people's opinions of them across time. Like the general public opinion, go on the internet, you're going to get a bunch of fanatics, you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing is a rise in popularity of deconstructions of the superhero genre, which is typified by The Boys. I think you also got a little taste of it early on with things like was that new reboot of The Watchmen.
They had The Watchmen that came out too early for people to be ready.
I'm not talking about Zack Snyder's.
I know.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking
about. No, I mean that it wasn't super popular, and I think it's because it came out too early in the arc of popular. Because it came out before Endgame.
Yeah, because that was the one where there was like The Watchmen, but in the future, where like they deal with the KKK and they talk about the Tulsa race riots and a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and they do stuff like make. A lot of people were pissed off because they made Rorschach exactly what he would be,
which is a fucking villain.
They made people who found his journal conspiracy theorists who on the level of QAnon,
which is exactly what Rorschach would be. Is like,
but a bunch of like dumb chuds who were like, I love Rorschach, and then Alan Moore's over here like, you're fucking insane. Alan Moore is awful.
Alan Moore's whole quote was, if he's like, I won't come within 10 feet of anyone that thinks Rorschach was a hero.
Yeah, it's like, he's and this is Alan Moore, of course, he's going to immediately like say it to someone's face. Like, he's had people at cons come up to him and be like, I love Rorschach so much. And he's like, get the fuck away from me. Like just straight up, get out of here.
Get away from
me. Like, he's not supposed to be a good person, and you reading good things into him makes you a bad person. Like, he is a horrible human being.
So I think we have reached that stage, though, with superhero movies now, where your rise in popularity of anti-superhero movies. I think we also had that a little bit with what I want to call, like,
I'd say the only thing like keeping me watching any Marvel movies is the extreme bisexual energy through them.
I feel like Love and Thunder was like a gamble straight towards bisexual energy.
It was supposed to be Valkyrie and
Valkyrie and Hemsworth, you know, like
Natalie Portman, even though occasionally she was gaunt for the thing. But
look, don't get me started on my childhood crush, Natalie Portman. I wasn't big on like having crushes on movie stars growing up, because like I didn't see the point. But the ones where every time I saw them, I was like, I find that person very attractive. My two were Natalie Portman and Elliot Page. So I don't know what that says about me. Clearly, I was bisexual long before I knew I was.
Yeah, about to say, the universe revealed unto you. It was like you thought that was two straight crushes. Nope.
Like, seeing like going back and seeing, you know, like, you know, pre-transition Elliot Page in like a suit in Inception.
Oh shoot! I forgot he was in that.
He wears a suit in Inception a lot, and you're like, I was like, this is really hot, and now I know why.
The universe aligned.
The universe aligned for me. So I think to close that point, I think we've sort of reached that point with superhero movies. We're now on that downturn where people are finally critiquing the genre, which is something that we saw happen to Westerns. I think we also had a little bit with what I was going to call like prestige TV, with like those sort of heroes and stuff, because you eventually ended with it ended prestige TV with Mad Men. And obviously, and like the keystone of it all, Breaking Bad, which like sort of critiques itself by the end. Like Walter White's a horrible piece of shit.
Oh yeah.
So like, I think those
were once sort of, again, lots of people still really like Walter White, yeah, despite him being hated, a massive everyone piece hated of Skyler, shit.
Despite the fact that she was right the whole time. Anyway, let's finish this essay. What do we got here? I thought this was a really interesting line, talking about getting directly into his politics here. An anarchist is not a wild child, but a mature, realistic adult imposing laws upon the self and modifying them according to an experience of life, an interpretation of the world. A rebel, certainly, he or she does not assume rebellious charm in order to placate authority, which is what the rebel heroes of all these genre stories do. There are always this comes a depressing point where Robin Hood doffs a respectful cap to King Richard, having clobbered the rival king.
Lol.
There is a sort of implicit paternalism in this sort of implicit paternalism is seen in high relief in the currently popular Star Wars series, which also presents a somewhat disturbing anti-rationalism in its quasi-religious force, which unites all the Jedi Knights.
Are we back to Wellesley and Samurai?
Back to Wellesley and Samurai again. And upon whose power they can draw, like some holy brotherhood, some band of Knights Templar. Star Wars is a pure example of the genre, in that it is a compendium of other people's ideas.
I mean, that's... Yeah, it is.
In its implicit structure, quasi-children fighting for a paternalistic authority in the end, stand bashfully before their princess while medals are placed around their necks. He starts off with a explicit call of like, this is what anarchism is.
Mm-hmm.
We're not just fucking children flailing our hands about. Like, we're rational adults making rational decisions based on the world as we see it.
Yeah.
Like, with, again, self-imposed laws, self-imposed rules. Obviously, I think a lot of anarchists would argue about calling it laws, but it's more of like a self-imposed rule system.
Yeah.
It's you on you.
Guys, there are plenty of lawful good anarchists.
Yeah, like, because you're following your...
Your law.
your laws. But, again, going back here to what we talked about earlier, that rebellious charm, that in all these stories where you have these rebel heroes...
And yet somehow they always end up being like, yes, King Richard,
yeah.
I defer now to you.
Robin Hood was a bandit outlaw robbing from the rich, giving to the poor.
He was a former noble.
Yeah, former noble who was robbing from the rich, giving to the poor. And then as soon as as soon as Aragorn shows up,
yeah,
he's like, well, actually, you are the rightful king. So,
and the person who was really doing bad was the bad guy who was taking charge while you were off on the Crusades. You know, like the sheriff is the bad guy.
Sheriff and King and John, who...
But it's like, honestly, the king was the one who appointed the goddamn sheriff in the first place, by the way. So, like...
Or was Sheriff of Nottingham appointed by John or by Richard? Who knows?
Oh, I don't...
But, actually, historically, it's very funny. Like, even though people remember King John as being this horrible piece of shit, if you actually look at him, he was fine.
He was a normal king.
He's just a normal king by most king standards. He just specifically, a lot of the nobles didn't like him personally, and they were the ones that wrote things down. And so he has this real negative connotation in history simply because a lot of the nobles did not personally like him. And Richard the Lionheart is actually kind of a piece of shit because he was crusading most of the time and only came to England like 3 times in his entire reign because he didn't want to be on that shitty washed out island.
The nobles were like, we like this guy because he's never here. We he's can not do whatever around we want.
To tell me what to do.
He's just off.
King John is trying to govern and we don't like that.
He's just off, you know, killing Middle Easterners.
Well, no, he was out there like doing handshake deals with Saladin. Like, yeah. That's, I'm pretty sure he was the same crusade when the Saladin was there. Don't come at me. I don't remember.
There's a bunch of crusades, and I didn't learn any of them.
I don't remember them. he takes about Star Wars, how Star Wars is basically just like quasi-children.
And I do think this is one of the few moments when I actually kind of disagree with him, but that's mostly because The Empire Strikes Back, like, kind of takes the Force and fleshes it out a lot more.
Yeah, I think this points to the fact that only the first movie had come out, and they hadn't really... They hadn't really fleshed out what the Force is.
Yeah.
Or how it works. And because we all know the Force, we think of... It's not like a thing that controls... It's a thing that like flows through all living creatures and binds them, and you can sort of tap into it for purposes. But it does have a will of its own, but its will is towards like peace and balance and yada, yada, yada.
Now, of course, you could make the argument that because its version of peace and balance is a galactic neoliberal republic, that maybe the Force is kind of fucked up.
Well, you don't know if the Force actually wants there to be a republic.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
The Force just wants there to be a balance between the light and the dark, which like you could also interpret as like a George Lucas trying to interpret like Taoism.
Yeah, I mean,
which he interprets about with the same alacrity of purpose that he interprets almost anything else, which is kind of poorly, but
yeah,
effectively sometimes for storytelling purposes.
Sometimes.
So, like, I think he's a little off in his interpretation of the Force,
but that's just because this is just the first Star Wars film, which you could make.
I can see why he would take that from the first film. Like that's fine.
And again, like we said, if the will of the Force. Is the Jedi Knights maybe in fact the
Force is bad,
kind of sucky,
because the Jedi Knights suck,
kind of suck.
I think that's just a little more about the Force, then we can probably skip that. Let's get to the end of this essay. Let's get to the
the
very end here. Let's skip read a little bit. Oh no, this is where he talks about something he likes. So the next paragraph is him talking about something he likes. An author named Alfred Bester, who I've never heard of. And he said this is what actually got him into science fiction. He wrote a story called
The Stars, My Destination, also called Tiger Tiger.
So in brief, it's a space story. This guy gets a hold of a material called pyre or pyre that basically is capable of like destroying the planets with a thought. And all the powers, all the great powers, the governments and stuff, keep trying to give it up to them for like careful stewardship. And instead, what the hero does is literally distributes it evenly to the public, allowing the public to take the future directly into their own hands.
Yeah, in the end, he scatters the stuff to the mob of the solar system. Here you are, he says. It's yours. It's your destiny. Do with it how you see fit. It's one of the very, very few libertarian science fiction novels I've ever read. If I hadn't read it, I very much doubt I should have read any more science fiction. It's a wonderful adventure story. It has a hero developing from a completely stupefied, illiterate hand on a spaceship to a brilliant and mature individual taking his revenge first on those who have harmed him, and then gradually developing what you might call a political conscience.
I know of no other book
which so thoroughly combines romance with an idealism almost wholly acceptable to me. It's probably significant that it enjoys a relatively small success compared to, say, Stranger in a Strange Land.
He's
emblematic of the fact that even we did not know who this.
Yeah, literally, I had no idea who that was. I had no idea about that story.
I guess we might have to read this.
A story about a guy who like basically gives everyone a hand nuke and says, the future's yours.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest. I'm an anarchist. I still don't think everyone should get a nuke.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes sense, you know, what he's doing here.
I get it.
Because obviously the metaphor isn't actually like world destructive power or whatever thing. It's more about the redistribution of power in general.
That's
this is where we finally get to talk about.
Okay. So
we're almost done.
I promise. We're almost done. We're almost through this essay. But he gets into, again, trying to talk about things he likes, trying to talk about authors you can read that have like good politics and stuff. And I just really like the way this paragraph starts. Cause it starts with a wonderful, little bit of a sentence here.
Yeah. A little bit of an acknowledgement.
It says, leaving aside the very worthy, but to my mind, journalistic, The Dispossessed by UK Le Guin.
It's quite hard for me to find many other examples of science fiction books, which as it were, promote libertarian ideas.
So he's just like,
listen, I know the Dispossessed, it's great. It's great. As a little journalistic, it's great. But, you know.
Besides that,
because everybody kind of already knows what that one is.
Because he knows everyone's going to go, what about The Dispossessed? What about
Dispossessed?
He's like, yeah, besides The Dispossessed.
He's like, listen, guys, I love Le Guin. Like, just calm down.
Besides that, everything else is hard to find.
Yeah. He's like, And that's just because Le Guin got really popular writing pulp science fiction first, and then occasionally, and then eventually dipped into doing like polemics with like Left Handed Darkness, and then eventually The Dispossessed, her most polemic of them all.
Yeah.
So.
What he goes through now is a list of authors and their books, which I'm not going to go through, but his whole point is he keeps saying these, there are authors who are anarchist, who have heroes that are anarchist, and yet whose stories do not actually promote anarchist ideas. That despite saying they are and having characters that say they are, the ideas presented by these works are.
And if you think about it, like, it can be really hard if you're using established tropes to help you come up with a plot or like a story. It can be really hard just because of how infrequent, like, libertarian or anarchist like stylings
are.
Yeah. It's like there's just not very many tropes that fit into the right, you know, like how many, like mentioned before, how many chosen one stories are there? How many, you know, rightful king, rightful heir, how many stories about heroes, you know, becoming assuming some kind of power, or like being a good guy because he like adheres to the law. It's like you have like a whole laundry list of tropes that fit, that are extremely popular, that fit almost exclusively non-anarchist storytelling.
Yes.
But not very many tropes that fit into anarchist storytelling, just because there's so little of it.
Yeah, and I think that's what he's pointing out. Like, nobody knows who this other guy was.
So even anarchists trying to write anarchist stories come up short because there's just not a well of...
Popular,
recognized they haven't tropes. Read enough of it. You know what I mean? It's like people read a lot of fashy science fiction, so it ends up in their writing. Even if they're anarchists, because like that's just the well they're drawing on. Yeah. So if you guys want to go here and find a list of authors, we're not going to list them all off because there's a lot.
See what, like a final paragraph here. I think we can.
What Heinlein or Tolkien lack is any trace of real self-mockery.
I mean, yeah, Tolkien was incredibly self-serious.
Yeah. They are nature's urbane Tories. They'll put an arm around your shoulder and tell you their ideas are quite radical too, really. That they used to be fire eaters in their youth. That there are different ways of achieving social change. You must be realistic and pragmatic. Okay, so...
Next time you pick up a Heinlein book, think of the author as looking a bit like General Eisenhower. Or, if that image isn't immediate enough, some chap in early middle age, good-looking in a slightly soft way, with silver at the temples, a blue tie, a sober three-piece suit, telling you with a quiet smile that Margaret Thatcher cares for individualism and opportunity above all things, as passionately in her way as you do about yours. And then you might have some idea of what you're actually about to read.
Yeah, so his conclusion here is essentially just pointing out that, like... A lot of authors like Heinlein or Tolkien don't have any self-mockery. They're extremely self-serious. There's an element of objective, like, belief mm-hmm. to their work.
Yes.
That it just goes completely unquestioned. And it's like they're charming. It's like they're really just like these bandit here. They're charming. And they'll put their arm around you and be like, my ideas are really radical. Like, they're very radical, right? When in reality, like, it's like Margaret Thatcher in a trench coat.
Yeah, like, well, when I was young, I was like you too. Then I got older and realized there's multiple ways you can go about doing societal change. Like, I've got radical ideas. I just want to go about
I grew
it
up and became
way.
A homeowner, and now I'm voting Tory.
We can, you know what? No, we can definitely improve the state in other ways besides violent revolution. Like, we could vote it in or something.
We could, listen, guys, like, Margaret Thatcher cares a lot about our individualism. You know, it's like very important that we are allowed to be our individual selves.
If your individual self is a landlord,
if your individual self is a white, straight landlord, male, yeah. And a whole laundry list of other little caveats and checkboxes that you have to tick off in order for that to apply.
So it's saying that these authors use these tropes that we're familiar with to
kind of
couch their conservatism in language that can be interpreted as radical, mm-hmm. language that can be interpreted as revolutionary. And they use this as a way, again, to come across as friendly and charming in their work, and that what they're doing is essentially lulling you into non-rebellion.
Yeah, like they're pacifying you. Another tool of pacifism by the capitalist establishment.
I mean, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, dude, we're radical too. Like, look at my work here. Like, this guy started off as like a beggar and he overthrew the king. I mean, I'm going to put the fact that he then became king himself.
And the system fundamentally did not change.
Fundamentally didn't change for anyone, for all the poor people he grew up with.
Oh, yeah.
They're all still poor, but like, he overcame it.
Individualism.
Which is literally just, you know, bootstrapping yourself via like a magic sword. Yeah. Or whatever. I mean, and we've gone in depth when we talked about The Shire about the fact that like all of like Tolkien's individual heroes were all just rich fucks.
Yeah. They were all landed gentry. Minus Sam.
They were all landed gentry. Like Aragorn is of a secret race of kings who's inherently cooler and better than everyone else. Legolas is
even Gimli's the son of an Erebor dwarf that was incredibly wealthy.
Gimli is the son of Glowin, who was one of the members of the quest that retook Erebor, uh-huh. which immediately conferred upon them great station and wealth by being one of the 13 dwarves.
Well, all of the people invited to the initial council of Elrond were extremely high-ranking, wealthy
people of their kingdom, and Gimli came because Glowin was too old to mm-hmm. make the trip. And Glowin was important because he happened to be like Thorin's uncle.
Yeah.
And like they were the ones, he was the uncle of the guy who was becoming king of the fucking treasure.
Mm-hmm.
Legolas is a prince.
Mm-hmm.
Boromir is essentially a prince.
Yeah, he's a prince regent.
He's a prince regent because the stewards weren't kings, but they were kings.
Yeah.
So like every single person in the fellowship, minus Sam,
was nobility or an angel.
is like rich or a noble or literally sent by God.
Literally in a guardian angel ordained by
an incarnate deity.
An incarnate deity of grief.
I know we're going over Tolkien a lot because for me this is like putting Moorcock's test to myself of the work that I love. The work that I've taken a lot of meaning for in my life is me doing what Moorcock wants me to do. I am doing the analysis of my favorite works and discovering where they fall flat. And it's the fact that literally every hero in Tolkien's story, aside from Sam, has generational or inherited wealth and status.
Yeah.
Like, sure, Aragorn spent a lot of his life poor and rugged in the woods, but because within him he had...
And he kind of did it by choice. He could have stayed
He could have just lived in Rivendell.
He could have stayed in Rivendell his whole life if he wanted. Yeah, but he was like, no, I have to go out and protect people. And
again,
like,
that's him giving his, like, it's the paternalism.
Yeah. Where he's, he's taking on the burden of protecting
The Shire.
Yeah. Of the Shire and, like, that entire, like...
And Erebor. Eriador, the western part. So, like... And even then, he gets to do that because of his blood.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking King Charles over here.
Yeah.
With his fucking little sausage fingers.
Jesus.
Like wielding a sword.
And then people be like, oh, but King Charles was really critical of like imperialism and critical of... It's like, I really don't give a shit. He's still a king. He dissolve the monarchy.
What I'm really hoping is that the newest King Charles has a reign as successful as the previous two Charleses.
Oh, Jesus.
If you don't know history, kids, Google it.
Yeah, sorry to all of our, actually not sorry, to all of our British listeners who came here from...
like the color of magic. Or like the light fantastic.
Sorry, your monarchy is stupid and ridiculous, as is any monarchy.
As is all monarchies, and the fact that people are getting arrested for saying there shouldn't be a monarchy is exactly the example of why
there shouldn't be a monarchy.
Well, the monarchy is only symbolic, then why are people getting arrested for critiquing it? Obviously, anyone who listens to our podcast isn't going to be pro-monarchy.
Yeah, but it's very surprised funny. That we think this.
Yeah, it's very funny, though. Again, may his reign be as
successful. Stop crying about a woman who didn't give a rat's ass about who you were.
May his reign be as successful as the previous Charles's. but no, so...
Yeah, the queen was great. Well, the queen didn't dissolve the monarchy, so she wasn't great. Sorry.
So, we've gone on for a little while. We just read large sections from this essay, but I think this is important because... What he says specifically is important to talk about. And also, he's a good writer. So, like, his anecdotes and things are fun.
Yeah, he's a funny guy.
And as I've rambled on, but y'all can realize that I've been doing this to myself since I read this essay for the first time, is that a lot of the things that are your favorites are probably bad.
Yeah, a little problematic, fools.
I he wouldn't tell me that I'm not allowed to enjoy Lord of the Rings. Moorcock wouldn't say that I can't enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Moorcock would be mad if I tried to argue, which I will probably do in a later episode, that you can take revolutionary or radical ideas from Lord of the Rings. Or he would point out the fact that the reason I can do that is because the structure of the story and the wording is so vague that I can pull a definition myself, despite that not being intended by the author.
Yeah, and that it's still fundamentally kind of a dangerous work.
It's a dangerous work for me to pull lessons from a story that inherently is opposed to my ideas.
Yeah.
So, like, I think he'd... like some like Moorcock at least be accepting of the fact that I am conscious that I'm doing this. It is a conscious choice on my part to recognize the work as reactionary and to still try and pull meaning from it myself, even though he'd argue that I should just read something better.
I mean, yeah, he'd probably be like, yeah, just, I mean, we are going to spend another episode here talking about Le Guin.
I was going to say when we could just read something better, which we do by reading Ursula Le Guin.
Yeah.
Which is better.
Yeah. By you know, reading Le Guin, by eventually reading Moorcock.
Yeah.
Once we get around to that. That'll have to be after October.
Yeah, I'll have to, after November.
After November, that's right.
It'll have to be after November. I don't really have any final thoughts. I think we've covered just about everything. Like, just be more critical of the media you consume. And not just like the message of this specific story is bad, but like, did the author even intend for this to not be bad? Like, what is the intent of the author behind this work? It is often bad.
Yeah, I still cannot fathom the apologia for Heinlein, even for Stranger in a Strange Land, because, like, I can't. Like, anyone who has ever read Starship Troopers and liked it is just fash. Because, like, there's no way around that at all. In that book, there's not even a good plot. So the only reason that you're liking it is because it has ideas that you agree with, which are all bad. So like, there are some like Starship Troopers that are really easy to point out and really easy to find
because they're so glaringly
obvious about it. But then there are, you know, there are others like, you know,
Anne McCaffrey, Larry Niven. Like all these other people who, like, it's not as easy to see the conservative and reactionary politics that mm-hmm. are embedded within the story.
Yeah.
You know, if you really want to read a book about, like, soldiers in space going through boot camp and then going to war with aliens, read Liberty or Death by Joe Kasabian. It's more well written than Starship Troopers. And actually gives you a pretty much better look about how much it sucks to be in the military and how stupid the whole concept of space imperialism would be. So, you know, like, go read Joe Kasabian's books. They're better. And you can still get your fix on about, like, watching a soldier go through boot camp.
Yeah. But with an actual plot.
But with an actual plot and written...
That isn't just about how we should spank our kids harder.
Yeah, and written by a guy who actually went through boot camp and have actually participated in a war.
And not a guy who was a... Navy Reserve engineer who just kind of like sat on a boat before computers were a thing and looked at an astrolabe and then left before any wars happened.
Yeah. Read the book from the guy who like got deployed to Afghanistan twice.
Yeah. not the one who was on a ship in the interwar period.
Loser. Fucking loser. Anyway, no other final thoughts. Again, I know we read like half the essay to you, but you can read it in like 15 minutes. It's really good. And you really should use it as a springboard to critique the stories that you read. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not that you can't enjoy them. You just have to be conscious and recognize them for what they are.
Oh, yeah.
And don't mistake their message for something more radical than it mm-hmm. actually is. Like, mm-hmm. like even like he talks about, when he's talking about Westerns, he talks about like True Grit and how people like to, you know, idolize a Rooster Coburn as this like rugged individualist hero. And at the end, he still at the end of the day, like submits to the authority of a judge.
Yeah.
So like, it's still there.
It's like, it's this, like, they're a rebel, but not not that much of a rebel that they would be against the law when the law in quotation marks is good. Right.
Insert Chomsky's justified hierarchies.
Yeah.
LOL, get wrecked, genocide denier. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
thank you all for listening. I don't know, depending on what order these come out in, I don't know what's next after this.
But October's Grim Fantasy Month.
Yeah, October's Grim Fantasy Month. November is going to be Cyberpunk Month. Yeah, so get ready for those. And I hope you also enjoyed Tombs of Atuan by Ursula Le Guin, which should come out before this, might come out after this. I don't know, depending on the order we record and release it in. But also read Le Guin.
Yeah, just read Le Guin. It's just fun, and their books are usually short.
Fuck yeah, I got you so.
Her longest books are her short story collections.
Oh, God damn it. Okay, goodbye.
Bro. Be fucking real, man. Come on. We'll be right back.